Dr. William Luther Pierce, the year 2000. Defying the Censors.
Hello. Did you notice a small news item a few weeks ago in some U.S. newspapers? Lucy Blackman, a 21-year-old English girl, disappeared in Tokyo. Her father, Tim Blackman, a very wealthy real estate developer in Britain, was afraid that she had been kidnapped by one of the sex slave rings that operates in Japan and taken to Hong Kong. Because Mr. Blackman is very rich, he was able to make a fuss in the newspapers and to offer a £100,000 reward for information about his daughter. Otherwise, Lucy would have been just one of the hundreds of attractive white girls who simply disappear every year while traveling in the Middle East or the Far East, and there wouldn't have been a peep in the media or any notice paid by government officials. The fuss Mr. Blackman was making about his daughter galvanized the Japanese government, which didn't want any bad publicity to keep Western tourists away. Tokyo police began an investigation. They haven't found Lucy's body yet, but now they have a pretty good idea what happened to her and to a number of other white girls. Lucy was a tall girl, 5 feet 10 inches, a slender, blue-eyed blonde, a beautiful white girl of the sort that the small, dark men of other races crave. And because of the craving Oriental men have for tall, blonde women, Lucy worked as a hostess in a private club for wealthy Japanese businessmen, Tokyo's Casablanca Club, where she was earning about $5,000 a month. She was, in other words, working as a high-priced prostitute. There are many exclusive clubs for rich businessmen in Tokyo, all of them stocked with tall blondes, some earning even more than Lucy. Japanese detectives traced Lucy to the luxury oceanside condominium of a Japanese tycoon, Joji Obara. She had been seen leaving the Casablanca Club with Obara in his red Ferrari. When police searched Obara's condominium, they found a collection of videos he had made of himself performing various sex acts on more than 40 other white girls. The videos, according to police, were horrific. Obara first drugged the girls and then sexually degraded them in ways too unpleasant to describe here. Obara is in custody, and police have been searching offshore for Lucy's remains, but have not yet found them. Now, what I'm talking about with you today is not a crime story in the usual sense of the word, and it's not primarily about what members of other races are doing to our people. It is about what we have done to ourselves. Here's a question. Why do so many of our young women put themselves in the sort of jeopardy Lucy put herself in? Of course, there is the money. There aren't many jobs which will pay a 21-year-old girl $5,000 a month. But Lucy didn't really need the money since her father was a multimillionaire, although she may have thought that the allowance Daddy gave her was not enough to satisfy her craving for clothes, jewelry, and the like. A more significant answer, I believe, is that our women do what Lucy did because we permit them to do it. As far as I've been able to determine, Blackman and his daughter had a close relationship. She was not alienated from her family. Blackman could have prevented his daughter from working as a hostess for Japanese businessmen, but he didn't. It would have been sexist for him to try to prevent his daughter from doing whatever she felt like doing, even selling herself to rich businessmen. And it would have been racist for him to tell her not to have sex with rich Japanese businessmen in particular. As I mentioned last week, Brits are even more inclined to be politically correct than Americans are. They are more conformist, more authoritarian. When it is politically correct for a father to give his blessing to his daughter having sex with Asians or mestizos or blacks, a right-thinking, lemming father will do it. You know, when Negro football player O.J. Simpson slashed the throats of his beautiful blonde wife, Nicole, and her Jewish lover 6 years ago, my reaction was, good riddance. White women who voluntarily have sex with non-whites deserve to have their throats cut, all of them. And because Lucy willingly put herself at the disposal of Japanese men, it is hard to feel sorry for her when one of them turned out to be a pervert who murdered her. During the Simpson trial, my opinion was that Nicole's father also deserved to have his throat cut because of the way he had raised his daughter. He had failed to teach her that she must never, under any circumstances, permit a non-white to touch her. And for that failure, he deserved the severest punishment. And I could say the same thing about Mr. Blackman now, but I guess I really shouldn't. And the reason I shouldn't is that lemmings simply aren't morally accountable. They have no true moral consciousness. They do not have the capacity to be either good or evil. They simply think and do whatever is fashionable at the moment, whatever they think is expected of them. Of course, that doesn't mean that some of them shouldn't be killed from time to time, but it's more a matter of herd management, of herd control, than punishment in the moral sense. From the beginning of recorded history up until 30 or 40 years ago, any father in a white society whose daughter copulated with non-whites would lose everyone's respect. He would become a social outcast. A father's duty was to raise his daughters as well as his sons, to have pride in themselves, in their family, in their community, in their race. In ancient times, if a white girl were caught with a black or an Asian, then it was the father's responsibility to cut her throat. The Roman paterfamilias, for example, understood and accepted that responsibility. Well, the American or the British father of today, typically a pot-bellied couch potato swilling his beer and watching his ball games while his children do whatever they please, has come a long way down from the paterfamilias. But I suppose it would not be entirely fair to blame him alone. The Roman father did what he did because that is what his society expected of him, demanded of him. The 21st century father does nothing because his society expects nothing of him. In fact, it virtually prohibits him from doing anything. He has been emasculated and disempowered. He has become a sorry, impotent figure indeed. Of course, the way in which we raise our daughters is just one symptom of the sickness of our society, but it is an important symptom. We abdicate our family responsibilities. We let the Jews teach our daughters, primarily through advertising and television entertainment, that they should have no pride in their race, that there should be no constraints on their behavior, that they should do whatever they want to do, whatever their peers are seen doing on the television screen, and then we just dump them out into the multicultural jungle to fend for themselves with no protection and no guidance. It is no wonder that so many of them follow the course of Nicole or Lucy. They see nothing wrong with it. They've never been taught what they should and shouldn't do, except, of course, that they have been taught by Hollywood and Madison Avenue that it is especially modern and commendable, especially cool, a sign of sophistication to bed down with every piece of non-white subhumanity which comes strutting or shuffling down the sidewalk. So, if we want to improve the behavior of our daughters, if we want them to avoid the fate of Nicole and Lucy, we need to do more than preach to their fathers. We need to change the society which sets the standards for the behavior of fathers and imposes certain responsibilities on fathers and gives them the freedom to exercise those responsibilities. And we need to change the way in which our society treats our women. Well, what we need to do and what we are able to do are often far apart, of course. And that's the case with changing our society in such a way as to give us strong and proud and healthy families again, which produce strong and proud and healthy sons and daughters instead of confused, rootless, alienated, and defenseless young people like Nicole and Lucy, who have no sense of identity and no racial pride, whose only aim is seeking pleasure and comfort, and who are at the mercy of every alien predator out there. We can't really change our society until we can change the directions in which the mass media are pushing it. I'll talk about the media again in a moment. But first, let's think about some of the changes we'd like to make in our society after we regain control of our media. At least about one change. And that's the role and nature of the family. Many people believe that we're all much smarter today than we were 1,000 years ago because we can fly to the moon and we have cell phones and television. And they believe that because we're smarter, we also have a better society, which has been made possible by our greater intelligence and all of our new gadgets. But I don't share that belief. The gadgets we have today are the consequence of a recent technological revolution which has very deep roots in the past. And the people who are implementing that technological revolution today are not really smarter than the people who established those roots in the past. The bright and creative men who give us cell phones and all sorts of other microelectronic gadgetry today are standing on the shoulders of men at least as bright and creative who gave us our first understanding of electricity and electromagnetic fields and radiation hundreds of years ago. Men such as Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell, and the men who designed the rockets and the spaceships which took us to the moon. Men like Wernher von Braun were standing on the shoulders of earlier geniuses such as Isaac Newton. And so it goes back to the ancient Greeks and earlier. Of course, we can't give IQ tests to the ancient Greeks, but if we could, if we could take 1,000 Greek teenagers from Athens and Sparta of 25 centuries ago and compare them with 1,000 white American teenagers today, I believe the Greeks would leave the Americans in their dust. In fact, I believe that intelligence and creativity have been going downhill since the Neolithic Revolution first made it possible for the less bright elements of society to be sheltered from the natural selective forces which used to keep us fit. And since the introduction of the modern welfare state in the last century, we have plummeted. Certainly, a very high percentage of today's couch potatoes would never live long enough to reproduce if the technological infrastructure which shelters and supports them were taken away. So, the ancients hadn't yet developed the tools with which to fly to the moon, but they did understand some things about families and other social structures and institutions. These were structures and institutions which had evolved over hundreds of thousands of years and adapted themselves very closely to our nature, to our biological and psychological makeup. Every now and then a very bright leader might introduce some change, some improvement. But the changes were made slowly and very carefully because no one wanted to mess up what nature had spent so long developing and refining. No one wanted to mess up what worked and did the job it was intended to do, which was to keep the society, the tribe, the community, the nation strong and healthy by producing strong and healthy young men and women to form each successive generation. But we, in our arrogance, have made some very drastic changes in a big hurry, and we've made these changes without consideration for the consequences. That's why, when I try to understand what's wrong with the society of today and the family of today and how we might improve them, I often look at older models. I look at what worked in the past before we began making such reckless changes. I don't recommend that we try to model the American family of the 21st century on the Roman family of 23 or 24 centuries ago in detail. But I do think that we must keep in mind that, technological advances notwithstanding, the fundamental nature of our people hasn't really changed, except that we're not quite as smart on the average as the Romans were. We need to keep in mind that the basic human qualities we have and that we must deal with, the Romans also had and dealt with, and did it fairly successfully. The family must have a mother and a father living together with complementary roles. There must be a mother at home in charge of the children while the father is engaged in the task of supporting the family. And there must be a strong central authority vested in the father of the family. That much we must have again as a basic structure. Beyond that, the family must mold and guide the children so that they grow up with the proper values. That task must not be left to the street, to the playmates, to the passing fashions of the day. Well, that's a pretty skimpy outline without much detail. I don't like to build castles in the air. I don't like to make detailed plans until we have the means for implementing those plans. It's not realistic to plan the rebuilding of our society until we have the media which control public opinion in our own hands. I think it's good to look ahead, however, and plan things in rough outline, to think about where we want to go. But our principal task now remains the recapture of our mass media. And you know, sometimes I do see a glimmer of hope, a small sign that we're making a little progress in this task. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, a professor from one of our major universities approached me and said that he had liked to write a book about my organization, the National Alliance, and its ideas, and about me. I said, okay. And so he spent a month working in my national headquarters here in West Virginia, and we talked a great deal. And he read many of the books I recommended to him and listened to many of my radio broadcasts. And then he spent a year writing his book. He's Dr. Robert Griffin. And he's a professor in the Department of Education at the University of Vermont. His book is titled, The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, an up-close portrait of white nationalist William Pierce. It's not the book I would have written on that subject. There are a few things in the book which make me flinch, and a few things which make me blush. But it is a fair book, an objective book. And more important, it's a substantive book, a book with some real meat in it. It does a very good job of presenting the ideas which I talk about on these programs. And it presents them in a way which makes them very easy to assimilate. Robert Griffin is a good writer. He knows how to present ideas. Well, as an education professor, he ought to know how to present ideas clearly and simply. And he does. It's a good book, a well-written book. After he finished the book, Professor Griffin and his literary agent began sending it to New York publishers. He already had had books published, and he thought he'd have no trouble finding a publisher for this one. Well, he was wrong. Dozens of major publishers read the book, told him it was a good book, but they couldn't publish it because it wouldn't sell. The public won't read it, they said. The public isn't interested in that sort of thing. The public will be offended by many things in the book. We have a formula for writing books on controversial subjects like this, they said. It's a formula for books which will sell. Your book doesn't fit the formula. So we're sorry, but we can't handle it for you. We would lose money if we published it. Dr. Griffin spent a year trying to get his book published, but he always got the same answer. Finally, last month, in desperation, he went to Barnes & Noble, the world's largest bookseller, and asked them to publish it on the Internet as an e-book, the way the best-selling novelist Stephen King had one of his books published a few months ago. And that's what they did through their e-book division, MightyWords.com. Any Internet user can go to the MightyWords.com website, pay $8 with his credit card, and download Dr. Griffin's book, all 424 pages of it. Then he either can make a printed copy of the book with his printer, or he can read it on his monitor. Well, here's what happened. On October 10th, Barnes & Noble posted the book at the MightyWords.com site. Within a few days, it moved onto the bestseller list. That's the list of Barnes & Noble's 25 best-selling e-books based on sales figures for the previous 2 weeks. The list is updated every day. Last week, Dr. Griffin's book moved to the top of the bestseller list. And that's where it has remained since then. The number one best-selling e-book from the world's largest bookseller. And that's without any reviews in the New York Times, without any advertising or promotion, without any book signing parties, without being offered in any book catalog. All that happened is that a few people ran across the listing of the book at the Barnes & Noble e-book site, decided to check it out, were fascinated by what they found in the book, and began telling their friends. And the word spread from reader to reader like a wildfire. That is why Dr. Griffin's book about me jumped to the top of the bestseller list and stayed there. What does that tell us? Does it tell us that New York publishers don't know what will sell? No, I think what it tells us is that New York publishers are a bunch of politically correct cowards. They are scared to death of publishing anything which will subject them to criticism from the you-know-whos. They are not only lacking in imagination, they are gutless. This is interesting because the book publishing industry still has a certain degree of independence, theoretically. There are hundreds of book publishers in New York, and many of them are not owned or directly controlled by Jews. So one might think that an author could find a publisher for any book with a reasonable chance of making a profit. But it isn't so. Publishers self-censor themselves, avoiding publishing books which will bring the wrath of the Jews down on them. They pretend that they can publish anything they want, that they are free men, but they aren't. They know what they're not permitted to publish, or at least what they're afraid to publish. The one thing which is strong enough to overcome their fear is greed. And I won't be surprised if when some of them see the amazing success of Dr. Griffin's book at MightyWords.com, their greed for profits overcomes their fear of the Jews. Do you understand now why the Jews have been running around for the past year or two trying to build public support for censoring the Internet? Why they've been complaining so loud about how dangerous it is to leave the Internet uncensored? All of the big Jewish hate groups, such as the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rit and the Simon Wiesenthal Center, have been working day and night to get the politicians to pass new legislation blocking anything they don't approve of from going on the Internet. So far, they haven't succeeded. It's important that they never succeed. The success Dr. Griffin has had with his politically incorrect book should provide new hope for everyone who had assumed that the Jews had such a tight grip on the dissemination of information that it couldn't be broken. It can be broken. It will be broken. The true feelings of hundreds of thousands of concerned white Americans who have not had a voice will come out into the open, and the lemmings will notice. Thanks for being with me again today.